Leadership Show with Andy Peck.
It's my joy to welcome you to another episode of The Leadership Show, the show that aims to help you use your influence as you partner with God in seeing his purposes fulfilled and good triumph over evil. As always, I'm Andy Peck, your host, and whether you're listening live on a Sunday or via a podcast, it's great to have you along. We have noted before that one of the jobs of the leader is to define reality, to give voice to what's going on so that it can be faced and dealt with. But it is also important to acknowledge what reality is in our own lives as we come to terms with who we are and how life has affected us. I'm joined this week by a leader who has been exploring these issues. His name is Patrick Regan, OBE, former founder and CEO of XLP, and now CEO of Kintsugi Hope. 3 years ago, he wrote the book Honesty Over Silence, which helps give permission for us to acknowledge when we struggle with mental and emotional health. Today, he joins me to talk about his new book, Bouncing Forwards, Notes on Resilience, Courage and Change, published by Waverley Abbey Resources. And this looks at how we can flourish amidst our challenging circumstances. There's a wealth of material here for leaders to digest for themselves, but also as they lead people battling with mental and emotional health issues. So Patrick, great to have you back on The Leadership Show.
Thank you very much for having me.
You were last on the show in 2007, so it's certainly high time we had you back. But a delight given the excellent book. I had the chance to see a pre-publication copy, so many congratulations.
Thank you very much.
So I've had a chance first for you to describe the book in your own words.
Yeah, well, I started writing this book in January 2020, and it really came as a result of my last book, which you mentioned, Honesty Over Silence. Honesty Over Silence had a tagline that said, "It's okay not to be okay." And I received so many emails that were both heartbreaking and heartwarming of people telling me their story. And as I read the emails, I thought, I firmly believe it's okay not to be okay, but I don't want people to get stuck not being okay. I want them to thrive. So I said to my publisher, I think I want to write a book on resilience, because resilience, by definition, is thriving in the midst of adversity. But then, of course, Andy, COVID hit, and then the unjust murder of George Floyd. And I said to my wife, you know, how on earth am I going to write a book about thriving in adversity with this as the background? And she said, you know, it's got to be for a time such as this. And as I studied resilience, I looked into psychology and to theologians, activism, business, poetry. I tried to draw on so many different sources. Is a lot of people describe resilience as bouncing back. And I was like, I don't want to bounce back. I feel like, why would I want to go back to my self that's been through so much less than what I've been through now? Because those lessons have taught me stuff. They've challenged my values that I've changed. And it's not that I would choose to go through it again, but actually I don't want to bounce back. And we hear it on the TV all the time, you know, will the economy bounce back? Will schools bounce back? Will the church bounce back? And as I look deeper into the issues around resilience, I found a better definition that says resilience is more about bouncing forwards. It's more about taking all that stuff that's happened, good and bad, and realizing it's part of us now and how we see the world. So that's a little bit about what the book is all about.
No, fabulous. So it's the subtitle is Notes on Resilience, Courage and Change.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I feel like that is really sums up where we are, isn't it, as a society. There's lots of change. And it's interesting, actually, one of the first chapters, and you sort of almost alluded to this in your introduction, looks at acceptance. And it says that acceptance is the first place to healing. And interestingly enough, I did a lot of research into people that survived Auschwitz and the concentration camps and POW camps in Vietnam. And they said the people that didn't survive were the optimists, were those that would go, I'll be out by Christmas or I'll be out by Easter. Because Christmas and Easter would come and go and they'd be heartbroken.
Yeah.
The people that survived were those that accepted the situation, adapted to it, but never lost hope. Yeah. And I sort of feel like where we're at the moment, you know, is like we've got this roadmap, we've got all these dates, we've got all these hopes. Mm. And actually, maybe we need to accept that this is going to be a bumpy road. We need to accept that as leaders, we need to accept that as individuals, and adapt and change and innovate, but also never to give hope, never to give up hope.
Sure. Well, I enjoyed skimming through the book, Patrick, very much, and you know, commend you for the research and the background that you've gone into. So it's you know, both anecdotal but also very, very much earthed in the latest psychological and emotional understanding, scientific understanding. You referenced psychologist Susan David, who describes the ability to put distance between our circumstances and feelings and our actions as mental or emotional agility. She says how we deal with our inner world of emotions and feelings drives everything, which is a big claim. But I guess most of us know this instinctively from a leadership angle. But nevertheless, it's worth kind of highlighting. And I liked her phrase, courage isn't the absence of fear, rather it's fear walking. So I wonder if you could just unpack that a little bit in terms of your own leadership and how you found that resonance with those kind of words.
Yeah, I mean, I love Susan David's stuff. And I mean, she was greatly influenced by Viktor Frankl, who was in Auschwitz and concentration camps. And he talked about there is a space between stimulus and response. And it's often finding that space. Otherwise, we respond too quickly. And we've all done it, haven't we, as leaders? We've all sent that email and then regretted it afterwards. And I think the really helpful thing about Susan David is that, and others like Brené Brown and others have said this as well, is to get curious around what your emotions are trying to tell you. Because our emotions are like data. They're telling us something. And I've definitely found this. I found this with the emotion of anger, actually. You know, I was always taught in the church that anger is bad. And if I ever heard a sermon on anger, the only sermon I ever heard on anger was Jesus and the Money Changers. Even though it's like they're all over Scripture. And, you know, in Ecclesiastes, it talks about don't let anger become a resident. It doesn't say don't let it become a visitor, interestingly enough. You know, Ephesians talks about don't let the sun go down on your anger. But I think anger is an emotional response to pain. It's telling you there's an injustice. There's telling you there's something wrong. Mm. And I think what a lot of us have done with that anger, when stuff has gone wrong in our lives, we've suppressed it. And then it comes out in other ways. And so now when I'm feeling some of these emotions, I just want to get curious. Why am I feeling that before I respond? And I think it's really important at the moment with so much pressure around that we have that process. I mean, Susan David talks about it like this. She said, you know, you can either see yourself as one chess piece on a chessboard with one move. It's like the Queen's Gambit. I don't know if you've seen that. It was like,
yes, I have. Very good. Yeah,
mind-blowing, isn't it? It's like, oh my god, there are so many options. And almost like emotional agility is almost that step back and going, all right, there's more than one move here. There's some different options that I can do here. And I need to listen to my emotions, get curious, respond with compassion and courage, and then make hopefully a really wise decision. So I think the emotional agility stuff's really, really helpful for leaders.
Absolutely. And sadly, some leaders, it would seem, are more governed by their emotional than they ever realise. They think they're being rational, but actually it's coming from somewhere else. We need to touch on grief, Patrick, because you very helpfully write about that in the book. And of course, we're at a time in our nation's history where grief is very much part of the life story of sadly so many at this time. You talk about the classic book On Death and Dying and the five classics, the sort of classic five stages of grief, but they didn't quite work for you. So talk me through how that was.
Yeah, I guess when looking at that and thinking about the grief that I've experienced in my own life, I sort of felt like I got into one stage and then felt like I flipped back to another one. Yes. Instead of finding there's an easy route to go through, you know, to get to acceptance, I was like, I was in anger, and then I was in bargaining, and then I was accepting, and I was like, I don't think this works. And really interestingly, Tanya Marlow, a theologian, she really helped me out in this. And she said, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who wrote the Five Stages of Grief, actually was writing that for people who were dying. It wasn't written for those that were being left behind. It was that process that people go through when they get a diagnosis that sometimes can last weeks, months, years, and they get to the acceptance bit, hopefully. But she said that actually for us, grief is messier. And an analogy I use in the book, which I found so helpful, is if you imagine a box and there's a ball, and the ball's grief, and basically there's a pain button in the box. and the ball bounces around the box and it hits the pain button. And particularly, it's taken up most of the box after a bereavement or after a loss, a big loss, a loss of a job, a loss of a relationship. And over time, grief doesn't disappear, but it can get smaller. But it still hits the pain button, but doesn't hit it quite as regularly. Fascinating, actually. My wife, a couple of days ago, said to me, she was really sad. And I was like, what's wrong? And she said, I really miss my grandma. And I was like, she died 20 years ago. Wow. And she goes, well, no, I'm just having a moment. And it was almost like the balls got smaller, but it hit the pain button that day. And she was it was almost like she was back there, you know. Hmm. And so I feel like to understand that that's going on is really helpful for people. I think that's why even during COVID, I've heard so many people go, oh, I had a really good day yesterday, but today I just feel strange. You know, I just feel him. And then, you know, trying to work out why you're doing that. The other thing I think is really helpful in trying to understand grief, and Tanya was brilliant at this as well. She said, if you can see grief with a capital G and a lowercase g, capital G stands for major bereavement. It affects every area of our lives. Lowercase g is for different losses. So for instance, during the pandemic, you know, my daughter had her 18th. We had to cancel all of that, all her celebrations. As you can imagine, that went down well. We had to cancel our holiday. We had to cancel our wedding anniversary celebrations. These are all little losses and they're not capital G, but they still affect us. Mm. And I think what Tanya was saying is, even if it's a capital G or a lowercase g, the process of grieving is the same. Now, the challenge we have is we go, I can't grieve my lowercase g because I'm going to compare my pain with your pain. And your pain is so much worse than my pain. So my sister is an ITU nurse. My sister is on the front line every single day. And I know at the start of the pandemic, I was like, I can't talk about how I'm feeling because Bex, my sister, has got it so much worse.
Yeah.
And she never put that on me. She never put that on me at all. It was all me. And I started in my research, started to realize actually we need to process and we need to name those emotions. Mm. And I think you're right, Andy. I think it's going to be such an important role for the church and for leaders. You know, over these next couple of years, people are going to need to have memorial services, celebrations of people's lives. Only five people at a funeral. You know, we've got to create space for people to be able to grieve well.
So, Patrick, I interviewed Will van der Hart recently and we spoke about burnout and how the trauma of this last year may affect us. In your book, you look at Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, who spoke of trauma being stored in your body. And when someone's been through ongoing trauma, it can rewire your brain to such an extent they can feel unsafe and therefore live on kind of high alert when they're not in any danger. And I thought that was an interesting observation, and that actually it's not just the grief dimension of this last year, but also the sense of high alert that we've all had to face. Because you go out to the shops if you had to go, and frightened of contracting something. And I just, yeah, that was an interesting dimension, which would be good for you to explore with us.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely true. And anxiety can be a bit like that, I think, particularly in the context that we've been in as well. I think someone said that anxiety is never allowing your autopilot to be switched on. You know, it's that sense of if you do a flight, at some point the pilot is going to rest and he's going to put the autopilot on. And anxiety is almost like you're on high alert the whole time. It's like a fire alarm that's going off all the time. And of course, fire alarms are really helpful because they tell you things are wrong in the house. If it's going off all the time, it's really hard for you and hard for everyone else. Because you can't live like that. Mm. And I found the research in trauma absolutely fascinating. The fact that it is stored in your body and not your head. And I've experienced this myself. I've been through some very big, hefty operations.
Yeah, your knees, was it? Your extraordinary leg operation, my word.
Yeah, I had a big metal frame attached to my leg. It was like drilled into my bones and I had to be adjusted every day. So they were trying to move my leg inside for 6 months. So it was horrendous. And so if I go in a hospital, my heart races. My head, I can tell logically I need to be there. You know, blood tests, x-ray, whatever it is. And so I think trauma is stored in your body. And I think how we process trauma is really important. I think the other thing that came out of the book was this, the research into ACEs, adverse childhood experiences.
Yeah.
And that really does affect the way you live your life. It can affect your health, your diet, your life chances. And so I feel like how we process this at this time is so, so important. And I think that's where professional psychologists can come in. Mm. I think that so often in the church, we've said, we treated prayer as a magic wand, zap me and I'll be better. And healing is such a process. And sometimes God uses medical professionals to help for us to process some of those traumas that we've been through, which I think is really important. I think then the last thing I say on it is that actually in the book, I look at what's called secondhand trauma. And I realized that as a leader that I have been to some of the poorest countries in the world. I've heard gunshots go off. I've had to, I've been in war-torn buildings that have been blown up. I've had bombs go off 40 miles away from where I am, staying in the hotel, and all these experiences. And I guess, again, because of the way we don't grieve very well or process stuff very well, maybe, is I never really processed that, And I think sometimes as leaders, we're surrounded by people's pain. We don't want to be a sponge. We don't want to be the rescuer because Jesus is the rescuer. But it affects us. And it's like, how do we process that in this time?
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things the book does very well is the next theme, Patrick, and that is the theme of trials making us. And we haven't talked about the name of your charity, Kintsugi Hope, and some listeners maybe have wondered about that as they've been hearing me talk about it. But Kintsugi, as a word, kind of connects to trials, doesn't it? So perhaps you could tell the story of how you named the charity and go on to talk about the importance of it.
Yeah, thanks, Andy. I mean, Kintsugi is a Japanese word. It means golden joinery. And so if we get a pot, we tend to mend it with super glue. And the whole idea of super glue is you hide the cracks, you pretend it's not broken. Whereas in Japan is they put a gold powder in the glue. So instead of hiding the cracks, they make a feature of the cracks. So arguably the object becomes more beautiful and more unique for being broken. And there isn't a pot like it on planet Earth. And I know that when I went through a time of real brokenness with my physical and mental and emotional health, it was the image that really got me through, and that God does pour in the gold, that things aren't wasted, and that he uses our experiences to hopefully bring good to other people. And so 3 years ago now, we started a charity that really wanted to look at how do we create safe places for people that are struggling. And we wanted to tackle two big issues, social isolation and mental health. And we did that by creating a 12-week program for churches to do with emotional mental well-being, written in learning styles, similar, I guess, to Alcoholics Anonymous, but around well-being. But we didn't just want it to be for people inside a church. We thought, wouldn't it be amazing if we could this be offered out to people in their communities? I always describe it as a little bit like Weight Watchers for well-being. It's like, get some friends, get some tools. It's not about being mental health experts. We've got experts that can do that, but it is about providing love, community and support and self-management tools. And it's just been amazing, Andy. Before lockdown, we were working with 40 churches running these groups across the UK. I think we're now at 231 with over 800 leaders. And the groups are running on Zoom a lot, but they're also running in homeless shelters for mums who've lost kids to foster care, in schools, in prisons, in youth groups, in sports clubs, in businesses. And it's really been such a helpful thing for people in this time to be able to get that support. So, sure. Yeah.
And there's a connection, obviously, with your former charity, XLP, which we also haven't outlined exactly. Well, that was came out of the knife problems that you'd experienced as a youth worker in London.
Yeah, absolutely. And, we saw something develop there in the grassroots where we were responding to some of those really complex needs that we saw on our doorstep, actually.
Yeah, yeah. So we've looked particularly at the emotional health and along the way at mental health, Patrick. But I you quote the research that says we have anything between 12 and 60,000 thoughts a day. But roughly 80% of these are negative. And you will know the value of, quotes, the positive mindset that that leaders are told they need to have. You know, you've had some, you talked about you had the severe physical challenges you've had over the years, and developing that mindset. What would you want to say to leaders listening about the importance of that, and also perhaps the importance of not following some of the kind of modern self-help type approaches to that?
Yeah, I think, you know, as a leader, we've all been there, haven't we? When basically you've been speaking, and then the Christian wants to come and tell you something in love, which is normally cue for "I want to destroy you." And then when you go home that night, if it's an evening service, are you thinking about all the wonderful things that people said, all the encouragement, or was it that one Christian or that one negative social media comment? And then what you do is you end up agreeing with it. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with constructive criticism, but you end up agreeing with it, and it takes you into that dark place. Mm. And I think that the biggest critic we have is ourselves. And I think sometimes it's about recognizing the inner critic and going, that inner critic is just so unkind. And, you know, we don't mind having constructive criticism, but when it lacks kindness, like my inner critic, there's nothing off limits. There's nothing, nowhere we wouldn't go. I just wouldn't ever talk to my worst enemy the way that sometimes we talk to ourselves. And I think that is true for leaders. And I think sometimes it's about asking ourselves, what are those alternative voices, you know, and trying to meditate on that, and what God says over us. And, you know, how about you're doing the best you can in a really difficult situation? How about it's okay not to be okay all the time? Everyone has a bad day. Not everyone is going to like you. I'm sorry about that. You know, everyone's allowed to have an off day. Struggling doesn't mean you're a failure. It means you're a human being. Actually, that's not saying that we're perfect. That's just saying it's a kinder way of talking to ourselves. And I think that's really important for leaders to grapple with that. It's almost like an internal thing that we need to not just accept. It goes back to your comments about emotional agility, that gap, that we need that in that sense of our thinking as well.
And so being kind to yourself is something you've had to learn and develop, it would seem, from the book. Yeah. You talk towards the end of that importance. Any particular things you've done that you didn't used to do that are now part of your approach?
Yeah, I mean, I felt like I've had to learn so much in this area, and it's an ongoing process for me, definitely. But one of the things I found really helpful in the book was the analogy of a resilience river. So if you imagine a river, at the bottom of the river, there's all these rocks and stones, and if my level of resilience is low, then I am going to crash into the rocks. And I guess those rocks could be disappointments, because life happens, church politics, I don't know, complex family situations, relationships. And we know that when we feel depleted, we're more likely to crash. And so I've really been through an exercise, and I try and unpack it in the book, is what are those things that increase my level of resilience, and what are those things that decrease it? And what I've discovered through doing this and talking about it is most people can work out what decreases their level of resilience. People aren't very good at working out what increases it, you know. And so for me, there's been things like gratitude. There's a chapter in the book about gratitude, which isn't cancelling out bad stuff. It's, in fact, there's a definition in the book that says hunt the good stuff. I quite like that. Yeah. Gratitude is hunt the good stuff. Look for the good stuff in every day. There's things about mindfulness, about being present in the moment, which is really helpful, you know, because we all want to plan everything. Mm. We can't control what's going on around us at the moment. So much is out of our control. There's practical things like sleep. I am rubbish about sleep, you know, diet, health, all those things. But actually what the process for me is that really healthy self-awareness. Which means that I know when I'm starting to get depleted, and I know the things that I need to put in my life. You know, for me, a big one is values. I've come to the conclusion that values are about priorities. They're about, it's not just what you do, it's why you do it and how you do it. And if I'm not living to my values, I go right down. So for instance, a big value for me is relationship. The last thing I want my kids to grow up and go, my dad was never there because he was always preaching. He was always doing this. He was always doing that. because I value my relationships with my family. Mm. And so I keep myself in check a lot of the time and have other people that keep me in check as well, which I think keep the river high and you'll be okay.
That's wonderful. Well, we've been talking obviously about bouncing forwards, Patrick, but Kintsugi Hope, obviously, that as a charity continues. What's next on the horizon for you as we come out of, quote, lockdown?
Yeah, well, to be honest, we exist to serve the church. And so our aim is to train as many people as we can to run Kintsugi groups all over the country. And, you know, we were so excited. It's just been so amazing. I mean, there's so many non-Christians accessing it, and it's just been so helpful to some folk. And Andy, I remember years ago saying to God, you know what, if there's going to be a big move of your spirit and it's going to be in a warehouse somewhere in America and a Christian TV station are going to beam it around the world and we're going to call it Revival, I think I might just quit. but you know what? If something could happen in small groups across our country, in homeless hostels and in brothels and in schools and in prisons and people's homes and coffee shops and pubs and hospitals, amongst the homeless community, and if it cannot be led by the great and the charismatic, but maybe by the fragile and the humble and the courageous, I'd love to see something like that. And so our job, I think, is just to try and fan into flame that passion that people have to serve people around the areas of emotional mental health. So we're going to keep on keeping on. We've got a youth version to help young people, student version that's come out recently as well, because there were so many completed suicides in universities. So, so for times such as this, I think it could be key.
Well, Patrick, it's been a joy to chat with you. Thank you. The book, again, is Bouncing Forwards, Notes on Resilience, Courage and Change, published by Wavering Abbey Resources. Thank you. That was my conversation with Patrick Regan on emotional and mental health, based on his book, Bouncing Forwards. There are many things I appreciated about the interview, but the importance of saying kind things to yourself and being kind to yourself resonated very much. I will be reflecting on what comes into my mind and whether the 80% is negative, as has been suggested by the research. It was A.W. Tozer who said that what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. So let's be thinking well of him and ourselves as those who bear his image. Have a great week.
The Leadership Show with Andy Peck. To get in touch, email andy.peck@premier.org.uk.